Amen. Lovely.
Okay. Censuses. Both our readings this morning involved the taking of a census. The whole reason that Mary and Joseph were on their journey to Bethlehem was because they had to register for a census, a Roman census. And in our second reading, we read of a census that King David asked be taken of Israel and Judah. But I don't know about you, but whenever I get a census dropping through the post or whatever, I just groan. You know, they say, or if you get it online, it's sort of, don't worry, this will only take a few minutes, like heck. You know, you're there for flipping 20 minutes trying to figure out this thing. And I hate them, I really do. But a census, if you look it up in the Collins Dictionary, says three things. It says, an official periodic count of a population, including such information as sex, age, occupation. Or two, any official count, e.g. a traffic census. And three, very interesting, it says, in ancient Rome, a registration of the population and a property evaluation for purposes of taxation. Purposes of taxation. So even Collins Dictionary has focused in literally on an event like this Roman census that Mary and Joseph are responding to. But this Roman census is all about money. It's about raising money through taxes. And the strange thing is, God doesn't seem to have a problem with this sort of thing. In Mark 12, verse 13, it says this. Later, they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. They came to him and said, Teacher, we know that you are a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. But you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar? Or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we? But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. Why are you trying to trap me? He asked. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. They brought the coin and he asked them, whose image is this? And whose inscription? Caesar's. They replied. Then Jesus said to them, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. And they were amazed at him. Taxation, raising money, having a census. Why might God not have a problem with such things as a census? Well, it depends on what the census is for, doesn't it? The reason and the intention behind it. Because there were censuses, if that's the right way of saying a plural for census. There were many censuses ordained by God to help raise tax. To pay for the temple, the Old Testament temple. And to fund the work of the temple. In Exodus 30 verse 11 it says, Then the Lord said to Moses, When you take a census of the Israelites to count them, each one must pay the Lord a ransom for his life at the time he is counted. Then no plague will come on them when you number them. And again in chapter 38 and verse 25 it says, The silver obtained from those of the community who were counted in the census was 100 talents and 1,775 shekels, according to the sanctuary shekel. One becker per person, that is half a shekel, according to the sanctuary shekel, from everyone who had crossed over to those counted 20 years old or more, a total of 603,550 men. The 100 talents of silver were used to cast the bases for the sanctuary and for the curtain. 100 bases from the 100 talents, one talent for each base. They used the 1,775 shekels to make the hooks for the posts, to overlay the tops of the posts, and to make their bands. So, God ordained censuses for raising tax. So, clearly God doesn't necessarily have a problem with this. But you see, censuses take a lot of effort and time to do, and they disrupt a lot of people. Not very clear on that map, but if you look at where Mary and Joseph started off up in Nazareth, they had to get all the way down past Jerusalem to Bethlehem. A lot of it through hill country. So they had to travel from Nazareth in the north, near the Sea of Galilee, down to Bethlehem. And it was a distance of about 90 miles, they reckon, which would have been walking, or if they had a donkey, riding on donkey. And they reckon that, you know, you're averaging about 10 miles per day. So you do the maths, you know, a good 9 days walk for a pregnant woman and her husband to get to Bethlehem in order to take part in this census, which was Joseph's home city. Now, the emperor, the Roman emperor at the time was Caesar Augustus, or his proper name was Octavian, and he ordered the census at the time of Jesus' birth. And he was to reign in Rome for 41 years. And he was the first emperor to accept the title of Augustus, which was a word that implied semi-divine. He was the first to start this emperor worship. But, you know, the focus is on this census. And we've already said that the census was for raising tax-raising purposes. It's all about money. But, you know, we've noticed that Scripture doesn't seem to criticise such census in order to raise taxes. God does it himself. And neither here now with Mary and Joseph. You don't seem to get a sense that this was a thing that God disapproved of. And it certainly wasn't a problem to God in terms of raising money for the temple in Exodus. But there was one census that God had a real problem with, and it brought great judgment from God. And amazingly, it was undertaken by King David, of all people, a man after God's heart. And we read about it in 2 Samuel 24, verses 2 to 10, as we've had the reading. What it is that David, we'll look at his reasons in a minute, but asked the commander of his armies for Judah and Israel to go and count all the fighting men. And Joab actually says something very interesting to the king. But he goes on and does the census. And it takes time, doesn't it? Because it lots of walking, lots of going to different regions to register people, to count people. In actual fact, we're told in verse 8 that it took nearly 10 months for this census, this counting, to happen throughout Judah and Israel. But why did God have such a problem with this census? Well, the problem was King David's motivation and intention behind taking the census. And we can deduce what David's intention, motivation was from verse 3 of that second passage. I'll read it to you. It says, verse 3, "But Joab," that's the commander, "replied to the king, 'May the Lord your God multiply the troops 100 times over, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it.'" But why does my lord the king want to do such a thing? Why do you want to go out and count the men? Kind of Joab's kind of saying, oh, I wish that the Lord would just multiply the number of troops you've got 100 times over, so you won't even have to think about searching for them or counting them. They'll be around you all over the place, and you'll see it easily, King David. But Joab didn't want David to go and count all the fighting men in Judah and Israel. So from that, what Joab says, it would seem that David wanted to know his army's strength and to be reassured of Israel's strength in numbers. Perhaps to be reassured, to give him confidence, or to have information about battle decisions and deployment of men, etc., troop strengths, etc. But the problem was that Israel and Judah were the Lord's army, and numbers were not any deciding factor or anything that should be trusted in place of trusting in God's fighting with and for Israel. The idea was to obey the Lord and trust the Lord in battle. That was always the factor. That guaranteed success. And in Judges 7, we can see this principle in action. In Judges 7, verse 1, it says this: early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that's Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Harod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Morah. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men. I cannot deliver Midian into their hands, or Israel would boast against me. My own strength has saved me." No. "Now announce to the army, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, "There are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will thin them out for you. If I say this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say this one shall not go with you, he shall not go." So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, "Separate those who lap the water with their tongues as a dog laps from those who kneel down to drink." Now, I'll just pause that point. The principle of that is, we're talking about fighting men in the field of battle. And the idea is that, obviously, there's a body of water here. What about those that just sort of kneel down? I've never known anybody actually drink like a dog, but, you know, the idea is that would lap from the water like this. And the problem is, you're not attending to anything around you whilst you're down lapping water like that. And you're supposed to be a warrior, a fighting man. Whereas if you are down there and you're cupping like this, you're cupping the water like that, you're attending to what's around you. If you're on the battlefield or you're in a campaign or whatever, you need to be fully battle aware. So 300 of them drank from cupped hands, lapping like dogs. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the others go home." So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites home, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and trumpets of the others. When it comes to the Lord, numbers don't matter in terms of battles. The point is, are you trusting in the Lord? King David knew this principle. He knew it well. But just momentarily, it seems, David stopped trusting the Lord and trusted in numerical strength and other things. So, let's compare these two censuses. This census that King David asked for, and the census that David, Joseph and Mary were caught up in, and they obeyed and travelled on to Bethlehem. And let's look at the spiritual morality of what was involved in the key participants in these two censuses. Now, as we said, the spiritual morality of David's census was one of a King David stopping just momentarily, trusting in the Lord, trusting in God's provision and help. Even if it was, you know, it was momentarily and total, a momentary thing and totally out of character for David, it happened. It happened. So there was a failing there in trusting the Lord by King David. Jump ahead to the census that Joseph and Mary are involved in. And we see the opposite in spiritual morality, if you like, revealed in Joseph and Mary as they followed the edict of the census. To unpack that, the first thing we notice that the travel to Bethlehem was ultimately ordained by God, can you believe it? Approximately 750 years before. And it was prophesied in Micah chapter 5, verse 2. It says this, God speaking through the prophet, "But you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times." For Mary and Joseph, the travel was not without risk, and it involved a lot of discomfort and some jeopardy, and needed some endurance. 90 miles. Remember the story of the Good Samaritan, the man who was attacked doing just such a journey that Mary and Joseph were on, and the story about who helped the man who was injured, who'd been mugged. It ended up being a Samaritan man that helped. Mary and Joseph's journey was not without risk, and it's a bit of a romanticized picture, that, isn't it? Mary on a first class Rolls Royce camel.
Donkey,
yeah, sorry. Do you know what threw me then? It was the palm tree, wasn't it? On a donkey, yes. It was still a Rolls Royce donkey, though. And Joseph with his Nike sneakers, Air sneakers or whatever, and going on a nice little jaunt down to Bethlehem. Well, it wasn't like that at all, was it? Not like that at all. There was no guarantee of safety in their journey. For Mary, goodness me, it must have been awful. As a pregnant woman riding a donkey. I can't imagine what it must have been like. And have you noticed, I don't know whether you're like, some people are different, but I don't know, I always feel quite vulnerable when I travel. It was probably because I grew up with my dad having British Leyland cars that you had no guarantee you were going to get from A to B without something horrendous happening. That usually involved my dad underneath the car wrapping exhaust bandage around the exhaust or something. So you just weren't guaranteed you were going to get anywhere without some crisis happening. But even take travel hubs, you know, like railway stations. They seem to be places where people wash up who are lost or are struggling in life or whatever. There's something about travel that for me speaks of vulnerability. You're moving out of your support network often, aren't you, if you travel? So it's an incredibly vulnerable thing. And it would have been like this for Mary and Joseph. But it was a journey to fulfill a census that God had planned and wanted them to undertake 750 years before, when he stated it in Micah. It was a journey that God had planned and wanted them to undertake. And the point was that it was undertaken, therefore, with God's blessing, protection, and provision. Folks, God often calls us to jeopardy, to discomfort, and seemingly to great risk. But because it's his path for us, it is the path of safety and security in and from God. There's this amazing contrast. Humanly, what God is calling to us to go through is horrendous. It's risky, it's frightening, it's anxiety inducing. But in actual fact, it's the path of safety and security in and from God for us. So what I'm trying to say is, that is to say that the most risky and uncertain and perilous course of action is in fact the safest for God's person or God's people to take that moment in their lives. You remember this psalm? Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. And here it is. He guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil. For you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. And sometimes we read that, and I'm guilty of it, and we miss the implication or the import of what the psalmist is saying here. The psalmist is saying that not just by some unplanned or unforeseen by God happenstance or fate, that I happen to find myself in the valley of suffering. That's not what the psalmist is saying. The path or journey that the psalmist is being taken on by God is purposed, planned, and it's intended by God for the psalmist. The psalmist says, he leads me, and he says, he guides me along the right paths for his name's sake, even though I walk through the darkest valley. God has guided him and planned for him to walk through this valley of suffering, of pain, of jeopardy and danger. But it's God's will for the psalmist. Let's think about that truth. Because actually it's quite radical. We have a version of Christianity called often the happy clappy type. And I have no problems with happy clappy worshipping the Lord. But it's a version of Christianity that is health wealth Christianity. What basically says is that we should only expect blessing from God. We should only expect good things money, prosperity. If we get sick, only for a short while, quickly get healed, and no pain or suffering, because that God could possibly not want that for us. Rubbish. I'm sorry, it's absolute tosh. We are called to follow a suffering Saviour. So we should not be surprised or fearful when we enter into a valley of suffering and think somehow we've made a wrong turning with God. No. Even when the course laid out for us by God seems the most tortuous and painful and uncertain of paths, it is the safest path for us, because we are at the centre of God's will for us. And that place, there is no safer place to be than in the centre of God's will. As Mary and Joseph found in obeying God's ordained path for them, they were safe in God's arms. And the psalmist is safe in God's arms, even though he's saying, I'm going to go through this terrible valley of pain, of hurt, of suffering, of worry and fear, but I'm at the center of God's will and I will be okay. God's path is the safest place for us to be. Let me read that psalm again. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. Yes, God does bless us. Yes, God gives us wonderful times when we're not hurting and we're not suffering and everything in life is going great. And we receive great blessings. Yes, God is like that. But the psalmist then says, he leads me beside quiet waters, he refreshes my soul. He acknowledges that this is a great time in his life. But he then says, he guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil. For you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. There's that modern chorus, isn't it, that sometimes we sing, you give and you take away, you give and you take away. You give blessing and then you give a time of hardship. We need to be at peace with both. Let me pray.